Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, welcome back to the show, friends. Today we're coming to you from Dallas, Texas, with our guest, Mr. Larry James. Larry, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for coming.
Good, good. Now, we are in your brand new building that just opened a few weeks ago.
That's right.
Down at City Square.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about the building and how long you guys have been.
You know, we built this campus. It's about 53,000 square feet under rooftop. Wow. And it's a workforce training center. It's a financial empowerment center for low-income folks. Mm-hmm. And it's a health and nutrition center. And we also have tenants here, Workforce Solutions, which is the employment office.
Uh-huh.
We have Literacy Instruction for Texas, which is helping people learn how to read or speak English. And we have Perscalis, which is an IT training company. So we've got lots of partners. We have our AmeriCorps team here, our summer lunch team. We have a big food distribution center. It's a crazy place. There's lots of people here every day.
Well, you've got a lot going on here. And when I first pulled in, I was just impressed. This is quite a layout, quite a spread you've got going on right here. But this wasn't something that you initially planned on doing when you, you know, got out of college, was it?
No, not at all. That's a whole other story. But I got into ministry during college. Had no intention of being in ministry. But anyway, worked with congregations for over 20 years.
In the Dallas area for good part of that, right?
Part of it. For the last 14 years was in Richardson, mm-hmm. at the church where I actually grew up. Anyway.
Yeah.
Been here, working on 21 years downtown and doing urban ministry, and it's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, you're in your book that came out last year, it's called The Wealth of the Poor, right?
Did correct.
Get the title right? Okay, so there's a line in there about your wife when you're deciding if you're going to do this. And
right.
She said something about, you know, you put into action all the stuff that you've been talking about for years, right?
Yeah, she said, you know, if you really believe what you've been telling us, just take the job.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So she was behind you making
it. I couldn't have done it without her.
Really?
Yeah.
Is she from the area as well?
She is. We knew each other growing up in Richardson, mm-hmm. and I've known her since second grade.
Wow.
Second grade Sunday school.
That's outstanding. And so she signed up to be a pastor's wife?
Sort of. You know, we were married right after our freshman year in college.
Really?
And I was still a history major. I was going to law school in my mind.
Oh, wow.
And during the first semester we were married, I had this call to ministry.
Uh-huh.
And so she didn't marry a preacher, and she reminds me of that quite often.
So is it a step up or a step down to go from lawyer to preacher?
Oh, I think I'm not going to answer. I don't want to incriminate her. It depends on what day you'd ask her, probably.
I know.
I think she has been much more pleased the last two decades with the kind of stuff I'm doing now because, you know, we don't have arguments in my world about the kind of music you pick or the songs you sing or whatever.
What are the kind of arguments you have then?
In my world?
Yeah.
Arguments about stuff like race and economics and the limits of unbridled capitalism and poverty and, you know, controversial stuff that's actually affecting people's lives.
Carpets, colors, and song choice seem so much easier to deal with.
You know, maybe so. And maybe that's part of the retreat into the world of the church is to escape the real world. It's interesting, though, incarnationally, yeah. God didn't do it that way. He jumped into the mess, and I think he meant for us to do the same thing.
Yeah, but it's easier to be just worried about the songs. Come on now.
Yeah, well, it's certainly easier. That's it, I guess. I guess it is. I don't know. I got all kinds of bad memories of that.
Yeah. Well, did you, when you were a pastor for some 20 years, was it a good experience?
It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was really great. Even in the worst place that I won't go into, there were incredible people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were just great people everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think one of the keys to leadership is to exploit that greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And let it be what it is.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Were the people at your church supportive of you making the switch to?
Yeah, they were. We'd been at Richardson East for 14 years, and you know, we're in the middle of a building campaign. It was a terrible time to leave. Things mm-hmm. were going well, but it just was the time. And so once kind of the shock wore off, mm-hmm. people were very supportive.
They were. Now, wasn't City Square originally was Central Dallas Ministries?
Correct.
Am I allowed to say that?
Sure.
Okay, but that was connected to your old church. To some degree?
Well, actually, the Preston Road Church of Christ mm-hmm. started the Central Dallas Food Pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came, we changed the name to Central Dallas Ministries. But
okay.
It really was not a work of my old church. We were supportive of it, knew about it, but we weren't connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of doing our own thing in Richardson, so we were occupied there.
Yeah. But you had always had a heart for the city and for people?
You know, my faith is very reductionist. You know,
what do you mean?
I'm believing more and more and less.
And
the edge stuff, I'll just leave it to somebody else, right? So for me, you know, my spiritual journey has led me deeper into works for justice and into relationships with people who don't have anything. Because I think that's really what was modeled for us by the guy we say we follow.
Yeah.
And so it's worked. It's worked for me.
Okay. So what are some of the things that you care about less as you talk about reductionist?
Well, yeah, a great question. I don't have any more time to argue about things like a cappella music, for example. It was part of our tradition.
Yeah.
I don't intend to spend another minute debating what women can or cannot do in the life of the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my mind, clearly looking at the Gospels, they can do anything, include being elders. Yep. So, I mean, so there's no limits there for me. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I'm not diminishing those who have a concern about that. I get it. You got a concern. It's a faith-based concern. It's yours. I'm going to let you have it. I don't have time for that.
You're just not.
I'm just not.
You're not going to fight that.
Not going to fight.
So the battles you are going to fight. Justice,
yeah.
Race.
I want to fight for public education students in Dallas. It's a mess. I want to fight for people who come here today who are hungry.
Yeah.
I want to fight for people who need health care. I want to fight for people that are incarcerated because they've got a problem with drugs or they need mental health services. You know, our mental health institutions in Dallas County for the poor are down at the jail. And there's something fundamentally wrong about that. So I want to fight about that.
Well, where does this desire to fight for that come from? Has it always been there, like when you were growing up?
You know, my dad was a guy who taught me that everyone was deserving of respect.
Yeah.
And that money had no role to play in that equation or that expectation.
Yeah.
So he was a huge influence on my life. But when I got to Harding College, now Harding University, I ran into some people like Jim Howard, who unpacked the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. And, you know, people, you know, even outside the university who helped me look at the gospel seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And then my churches were all in situations of poverty, a rural church in the middle of a soybean field, a little church on a corner of one of the poorest neighborhoods in Shreveport, Louisiana, a downtown church in New Orleans, three blocks off Canal Street. Mm-hmm. And then even Richardson for 14 years. We uncovered the fact that there was lots of poverty in that area as well, lots of hunger, a lot of need. And so as I worked through that practical reality with the text, I just began to develop these eyes for reading Scripture in a, you know, fairly liberationist mode.
Yeah.
Because I think that's part of the – I mean, I bring good news to the poor, Jesus says. What is good news to the poor? I mean, certainly good news to the poor is Jesus, but here's what I found about the poor. They would all tell you, I mean, virtually all of them, almost 100% would say, I got Jesus. Hmm. And most of them would say, that's all I got. So good news to the poor is not the message of the coming of the Messiah. They've already accepted that. Good news to the poor is probably a meal. It's probably a house.
Yeah.
It's probably decent health care.
Well, when the poor are saying, and I hate to say the poor, when people are saying, I've got Jesus, specifically in that context, you're talking about the poor, what do you think they mean, I've got Jesus?
I'm depending on God for the fact that I breathe.
Hmm.
You know, the common prayer in the inner city is, today's the day I wasn't promised, thank you, God.
Huh. Why do you think that's more common in the inner city than in the suburbs?
Because there's nothing here to depend on except what's inside.
Really?
And one another. Right.
Hmm.
So there's an incredible kind of community that's rough and tumble at times and anything but antiseptic, but very real, very genuine. I can't tell you the number of times that I've seen people with nothing receive something, and their first instinct is to share it with those around them who also have nothing.
Wow.
Whether that's a banana or a cigarette or, you know, a cup of coffee or an extra coat or whatever. I've just seen it over and over again. So there's this kind of faithful dependence upon God who's very real.
Mm-hmm. And so that enables people to be more generous?
Very much so. They don't consider they own anything, really. And I realize that's not true of 100% of any population, but I just tell you, that I've gone to seminary again at the feet of the poor over the last 21 years because I've just watched. Mm-hmm. So when people ask us, well, where's the ministry? How do you tell them about Jesus? We just all laugh because that's all we talk about around here is Jesus. Mm-hmm. But now we're trying to get people into housing. We're trying to get people into medical care. We're trying to get people into political engagement. We're trying to get people into educational opportunities. We're trying to get people into jobs. That's the good news to the poor. Mm-hmm. I mean, if my message is not good news to a poor person, then I got the wrong message. And certainly a part of that is to reinforce their faith in Christ.
Yeah.
But I found that that's immovable in the lives of most people.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, you talk about liberationist reading and liberation theology, and you know that obviously focuses on an idea that God has an emphasis for the poor and God has a special place for the poor and almost gives them a more important position than the rich. And you talk about, obviously, in your book, the wealth of the poor. There's obviously like this blessing that the poor can give the rich. Is it, in all of that, is there ever a romanticism about how great the poor are that is maybe inserted in there that exaggerates maybe part of the actual experience of all humanity, whether rich or poor?
Possibly. There's a romanticism at work kind of any way you cut that pie. But there is a reality among low-income people or impoverished people that changes things. And the social capital and the social intelligence of people with nothing is a vital part of community renewal. There is a romanticism about the expectation, and maybe possibly we may push people or expect more of people than they ever can imagine or dream that they could produce themselves. But when we recognize clearly and tell them how much we value the treasure they do possess, it's like, what are you talking about? And we have these amazing conversations with people who don't recognize their own power and ability and strength. And I got a lot of stories.
Well, give me one. Let's hear one.
Well, the seminal story is I came here almost 21 years ago, and we had a food pantry. And it was staffed by 15 or 20 old white people who look a lot like me today. And they were great people, sweet, kind, wonderful people, trying to help the poor. They were kind of burned out. Two or three of them were kind of ornery. And we weren't doing really well on customer service. And I could, again, tell you stories about that. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But we were not making a lot of progress in terms of community development. And one day, I think God just took mercy on me because I didn't know what to do, right? I mean, I'm a preacher. I got a seminary degree. I got a PhD work in American history. I've never had a social work class. I don't know what I'm doing. I just know that I'm supposed to do this. And so one day, three families are arrayed in front of me. They're each led by a Latina mom, and each family has two or three kids, and they were perfect strangers to each other, but I had them all there together. They were pooling their limited English to overcome the fact that I can't speak Spanish, right? And we weren't getting anywhere. I knew they needed something. I didn't know what. A lady that had already been helped, Josephine Ortiz, came walking by carrying her groceries, and I stopped her, and I said, "Ma'am, can you help me?" And she was delighted. She said, "Absolutely. What do you need?" It was almost like she was surprised that I would ask her for help.
Yeah.
And so I said, "I need someone to translate this interview because I don't know what these families need." Well, she sat down, set her groceries down. She didn't translate anything. She just conducted the interview. She'd been there many times. She knew the ropes. She just did it. Uh-huh. And we paid some rent, paid some utilities, provided groceries for everybody. These three women were getting acquainted. Everybody was happy. They left, you know, kind of in a cloud of dust, and they were thrilled. And of course, I'm on my knees literally thanking Miss Ortiz, Josephine Ortiz, that was her name, for helping me with this communications problem I had. And when she got to the door to leave, she turned back, and she said, "You know, Larry, I could come back tomorrow if you need my help."
Hmm.
And I said, "Well, you can certainly see I need your help."
Yeah.
And so Josephina came back tomorrow for 9 years, like every day almost.
Wow.
And it was in that God spoke a clear word to me that the solutions to the problems that we face in the city will emanate from, at least initially, the people who are already there.
Hmm.
That the wealth that's there is not, the most important wealth is not material
mm-hmm.
or financial, but it's social.
Yeah, that's
excuse
good.
Me, and that's just kind of a seminal story of everything we've developed since that day over 20 years ago has come from counsel with all the people who still volunteer with us who are from that community.
Hmm. That's great. That's great. Okay, well, let's transition. Let's talk a little bit about the race stuff. Race stuff.
I got you.
I don't know how the best to phrase that. But obviously this last week was the 59th anniversary of Rosa Parks.
Right.
And the Ferguson decision came down just a few days ago. And to say that you live right in the midst of racial things would not just be a metaphor, because the road that you're building is on is called Malcolm X.
Right, correct.
So you literally live in this context of
right.
Someone who, you grew up in Richardson when it was more suburbs.
Correct.
And so now you're a suburbs guy, you move kind of inner city.
Right.
And so you deal with the race issue all the time. And it seems like there's like this straw man. So if you're talking to someone who's a conservative, the issue is going to be, well, it's a personal decision. It's a responsibility. It's, you know, it's a sin thing, and, you know, they need to deal with that.
Right.
If you deal with someone who's a liberal, they're going to say, well, it's systemic, and you've got to fix the system. And so you get this scarecrow argument that, well, all liberals don't care about personal responsibility, and you have a scarecrow argument that all conservatives don't care about the system.
Right.
How do you deal with that? Because I know what you're trying to do, at least in your book, you talked about wanting to find a third way.
Right.
What does that look like?
It's highly relational. Okay. One of our big problems in this country is we don't have enough friendships across cultural, economic, and racial,
really?
Ethnic lines.
You think that's the...
I think it's a big part of it. I really do.
So I heard a stat that one, for every white person, they have 100 friends, only one of them would be African American.
Correct.
That blew my mind.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
I certainly think that's true in my generation.
Really?
You may be doing better. But just think about where we live. And how things are segregated mm-hmm. in terms of just housing and how that works. And it's income. It's also class. And I know it's David Brooks had an article yesterday in the New York Times about classism and how that's affected and mm-hmm. changed the kind of racism we deal with. It's more complicated now. But we're segregated in Dallas by economics. And so we just don't have, you know, I can... You know, here where I work, a third of us are white, a third of us are black, and a third of us are brown. So we come to work, I got about 150 employees here, and we come to work every day, and we're just all a mixed up crew. Mm-hmm. So we are, in that way, forced, some might say, but I would say blessed by the opportunity to get to know each other better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Nicholas Kristof has said it pretty well since October in this series in the New York Times entitled "White Folks Just Don't Get It."
Yeah, you tweeted links to that. I remember those after you did that.
And there's some interesting material inside those, embedded in those little op-ed pieces, including a little fun 10-minute test you can take to test your unrecognized racial bias. It's really interesting.
You know, I must have missed that.
Take a look at it because okay. it's really worthwhile. But, yeah, I mean, I think we don't have friends that are of other cultures.
Yeah.
And that makes us not so sympathetic. And we also have this unrecognized implicit bias that we were raised with. It's part of brain function to filter and deal with reality. And you have to be very self-aware to break through that, especially if you're living in an isolated ghetto of all whiteness. Are all blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is true there. I think
it starts with a relationship?
I think it starts with a relationship.
Now, when you talk about CityScore, you talk about it as a human and community development organization.
Right.
And so you got both of those in there.
Yep.
That's obviously for a reason.
Yes.
Which is?
Well, community development, typically, when you say that, you think of, you know, building businesses, building houses, providing homes for people. We do that. But also... we're in the human development business, whether it's skills training for jobs or volunteers from North Dallas who need to understand the inner city. It's human development across the board.
That's all we have
in mind.
Hmm. So why do you think we get stuck in that kind of scarecrow argument where, okay, if you're liberal, you're going to have this attitude, and you're conservative, you're going to have this attitude?
Well, you know, there are probably many reasons why that is the case. I think ideologically there's this, bias on the part of the right toward, as you've said, well, personal responsibility, which assumes that all the problems in the inner city are the result of a lack of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Gerald Britt, who's my partner here, is an African-American pastor for 22 years before coming here about 10 years ago. He reminds me often, you can't imagine the amount of time that's spent in black churches in South Dallas talking about personal responsibility. And if you tune in to some of those that are on media, like Bishop Jake's Potter's House, or if you listen to Freddie Haynes at Friendship West, or if you listen to Brian Carter at Concord, or if you listen to Tony Evans at his Bible Church, Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship, you're hearing a lot about personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
What's missing in that conversation is not more conversation about personal responsibility. What's missing in that conversation is, what is the result when people take personal responsibility?
What do you mean by that?
What is the economic impact of taking personal responsibility? Is that really getting you anywhere? In the white world in North Dallas, it's getting you a long way. It's getting you to the Ivy League for some kids.
Okay.
But in South Dallas, when I take personal responsibility, given my options, given my vocabulary, given my housing stock, given the nature of the sidewalks, given the healthcare system, is that really going to vault me out?
And so that's the systemic question right there.
Very much.
So if they
you've got to put those two things together. No one's saying we don't need personal responsibility. But clearly, we need personal responsibility. Yeah, I can't tell you the number of conversations I've sat in on with parents, particularly moms, who are counseling their young sons of color, particularly sons, about how to deal with the police in inner city Dallas. There's a whole culture of preparation not to get shot.
Really?
And there's this bravado stuff that's not characteristic of all the police by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm telling you, it's there among a percentage. Got a friend who lives on the street. He's not the easiest guy to get along with. He was arrested. Matter of fact, he was arrested on June 9th. That was my wedding anniversary. And I have a videotape of a bystander which graphically shows a police officer macing the guy, getting him to the ground, handcuffing him behind his back, and then trying to break his arms, pulling his arms back. And he was screaming and hollering for help. That police officer has been fired. But that's the kind of thing that happens here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not imagination. And it's not always the result of someone's irresponsibility.
When you see that video of your friend in that situation, being abused, you know, being mistreated, what's your initial response?
Oh, anger. Frustration. I call the police. When I saw the video, I called the Internal Affairs. And I wasn't the only one. But the guy who happened just to be in the parking lot who videoed it on his camera, he called the police. And we got involved in Internal Affairs. And, you know, that proceedings were started, investigation was opened, and that videotape term the day for that guy. I'm sorry the guy lost his job, but we don't need people like that on the streets enforcing the law.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement officials are heroes of mine, but the ones that are the true heroes are those who understand the fine art of de-escalation, who understand the fine art of not handling everything's one-on-one themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're the artists in win-win, not win-lose.
Yeah.
And community policing, where police officers are in neighborhoods as friends and allies, you know, rather than as adversaries, we need to go to work on. And the president, I think, understands that clearly. And I think his recent conversation the last couple of days about race in America and how we can move the needle in the right direction is much needed. And part of that is better training for law enforcement officials and better recruiting. We need a different kind of person. You know, I don't know what happened. I haven't read the 3,000 pages. I'm not sure if I read the 3,000 pages of Ferguson transcript, I would know what really happened.
Yeah.
But I wonder what was done, what could have been done to de-escalate. Maybe nothing. I don't know. I mean, I wonder, what if Mr. Wilson, Officer Wilson, had just rolled his window up and called for help?
No.
In the heat of the moment, law enforcement, and let's assume that Michael Brown had stolen cigars. Let's assume that he picked the fight. Let's assume he was a bully with a bad attitude. You know, let's assume all those negative things about him. Is the goal of law enforcement to take that guy out because he stole some cigars or because he had an attitude with a cop? Is that really what we want? I don't think so. There's a way to handle Mr. Brown that would not have ended in his death.
What do you say to the person who maybe has more of a pro-police, and I'm not saying you're anti-police officer, maybe let me say it a different way. But what do you say to the person who says, okay, so a police officer has a stereotype of, you have an African-American gentleman on the inner city, they're we're going to, what is the thing in New York where you can just stop and search them or phrase, right, whatever. And so they're going to say, well, that exists because how many times do we stop an African-American, frisk him and find, oh, he's got a weapon on him? Or right, how many times do we stop someone and find, oh, they've got a warrant out for their arrest? Or how many times do we find drugs on them? And the officer is going, well, I've done this for 20 years. I've been trained by the experiences that I've had to go through, in which my perception of African-Americans in the inner city is that they, many of them have criminal background or they're involved in crime. And so I'm doing this because, like Pavlov's dog, I've been trained to do it.
Yeah. You've been trained inadequately, and you need to rethink your training, because we're not going to get what we want, which is stability and health in neighborhoods with this particular approach. Young men of color are 21 times more likely to be shot by police officers than young men who aren't of color.
No.
That's just a fact. You know, the stop and frisk in search of Bloomberg, I don't know the details of that. It sounds like it was time for that to close down. But I think what we need is a totally different paradigm. We need a paradigm shift that draws us toward developing community. I understand that police officers deal with the worst element in our society. But to make the assumption that because a person is of color, that he should be profiled based on that and that alone, I think that's ridiculous. I don't know if you saw Cory Booker's letter to the paper years ago when he was stopped as a young man and frisked and made to sit on a step while the police called. He was scared to death. He was afraid he was going to get shot because so many of his friends had been shot by police officers. Cory Booker. I mean, as it turns out, he had done nothing wrong, and he was released. There was no problem. He was relieved. But if you Google that and read, I don't know if it was a Newark newspaper or the New York Times, but he wrote an essay when he was just a young man about what had happened to him, yeah, and about his emotions.
Mm-hmm.
If you grow up in an environment where these are the assumptions that are always made about you, that has some real psychic impact. Mm-hmm. And it changes the way you understand your culture and your context. And it produces outcomes none of us want.
Yeah.
And I think white people don't get it. They think the playing field is level. They think everybody starts with the same opportunity. And that's just not true.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Why do you think white people don't want to say that the playing field isn't level? Like, did you see O'Reilly? I saw this clip of O'Reilly. He was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart a couple weeks ago. And Jon Stewart was trying to get him to say white privilege exists. And O'Reilly went around and around and didn't want to admit it. Didn't want to admit that he had an advantage from where he was from compared to someone who is in a less fortunate situation. What are we trying to accomplish by trying to say, no, we've all done the same thing? And I say we as white people.
Well, I think it kind of puts a feather in our cap, right? I mean, I've got a good job, I've got a good education, I've got a good family, I've got good grandkids, everything's great. Well, mm-hmm. I'm doing good. Why can't you do good? Obviously, there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Somebody mm-hmm. screwed up. So mm-hmm. it wasn't me. I can see. So what did you do wrong to get that punishment? I mean, we're still very Calvinist in this country.
In a sense that we think...
We're looking for the mark of election. And the mark of election in American capitalism is money and success. Mm-hmm. And so if I've got it, then I'm part of the elect. If I don't have, or like you don't have, obviously, you're not part of the elect.
No.
God works his kingdom out on the earth, right? And so you're something, you've either fouled up really badly, or you've just been totally irresponsible, or you're just not part of the elect. Hmm. You're part of the damned.
Yeah. Interesting. So I think it was from that New York Times article, but there was a study that was referenced from Harvard and Tufts that said, and this is 2011, not like,
right.
I mean, recent, that said most white people think there's more anti-white racism than anti-black racism.
Well, that hinges on a fallacious definition of racism.
How so?
Well, there's a difference in racism and prejudice. I don't know. There may be as much prejudice against white people from the black community as there is prejudice from the white community to the black community. And by the way, I would say there's lots of prejudice. There's lots of residual prejudice in the white world. People who tell me that they're not racist, and by that, when they mean I'm not prejudiced, or, you know, they're just a lot of prejudice. I have lots of conversations, and there just is. Racism is prejudice plus the power to enforce the conclusions and the druthers of that prejudice.
So it's about power.
Totally about
power. Everyone can have prejudice, but it can only be racism if you have
the power to inflict, to inflict wounds or to create a system that benefits you to, at the exclusion of the benefit of others.
Yeah, interesting.
And that's the basis of white privilege. I mean, racism is not just I don't like black people. Racism is I don't like black people. And by the way, watch what I'm going to do now.
Yeah.
To make sure they...
So I've heard that someone made a comment this week somewhere on the internet that, and this has probably been said before, but the black-on-white violence is actually what's going on whenever you have racism. It's a form of violence that white people have power over African-Americans, and they can say, we're going to create a better system for ourselves, and that's really just ultimately violence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So, okay, so... If we don't want to admit this, like, what about the person who says racism is something of the past? You know, yeah, there was Jim Crow and there was, you know, segregation and there was slavery, but we're all past that right now. Why can't we all just move past it and get over the slavery thing and let's just all just move forward?
You know, that is a subject for conversation, but let me just tell you this. Here's something I've learned over the last couple of decades. That is a statement that needs to be made and championed by people of color who've been the victims of racism.
Why is that?
Well, the perpetrator, it's like domestic violence or it's like adultery. I mean, the person with the first and last word in those situations should not be the perpetrator of the violence or the initiator of the adultery. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me to have an affair and then go to say to my wife, let's just forget about it. You know, let's not talk about it anymore. There's no reason to talk about this anymore. We're way past that. Well, I've kind of lost my right to be the leader on that because
you're the one
I was the perpetrator.
Yeah.
It's really disingenuous. And I see this among a lot of young people. It's really disingenuous for young white folks to kind of lead with that. I think we need a humility that tries to understand the pain of our friends, and that it doesn't lead with that. I mean, you know, I'm willing to let you talk about racism till hell freezes over. If you're a person of color and you've been through it and you're trying to get me to understand it, you're important to me. And I want to hear that. I want to hear whatever it is. And I'm not going to say to you, well, now we've talked enough about that. Let's just move on as if it didn't happen. That's ridiculous. I mean, the residual impact of 1619 and the arrival of slave ships on this country is not over. The culture, the expectation, the backdrop, the background music of the culture is defined by that. And I would argue that it's defined by that historically in a way that other immigrants have not been defined. Other immigrants came here because they wanted to. They chose to, including your family and mine. I don't know any African American who wanted to get on a slave ship, given the conditions, and come across the sea to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell me more about why you think that it's still in the cultural background. So slavery ended, 150 years ago, something like that, and... we've moved past it. Why is it still in the background?
Because the economic impact and the generational predisposition and the setup, the cultural setup, it continues to have impact on self-understanding. I mean, the narrative of a family can be defined by that kind of oppression and the humiliation of that kind of oppression.
No.
And the guilt and the shame of that kind of oppression.
No.
I mean... The cultural messages that we send to one another about color. I mean, you've probably seen the study, I forget where it was done, you can Google it, but of showing little girls dolls of color and white dolls. Even the little girls of color will pick the white over the black. Well, there's more. We're not done here.
No.
We're just not done.
Now, is that, I wonder if that's what Du Bois would call internalized racism.
There you go. Yeah. Absolutely. And Du Bois says, and Gerald Britt told me this one, we were in Abilene, as a matter of fact, working with ACU and Hardin Simmons on a dialogue. Mm-hmm. Gerald's a Baptist, I have a Church of Christ guy, so we were out
there. So you're the right one.
Yeah, right. Sure. Anyway, we were out there together, and we were good friends, and he said, he quoted Du Bois, and he said, you know, it really is hard to be defined as a problem. And he said, that's how I, my self-understanding includes that, that I am a problem. And, you know, I thought about that. I just listened to, and I came back to him the next day and I said, you need to understand that, A, what I'm about to say does not in any way diminish what you told me, because I have no authority to change that. But B, you have never been a problem to me. And, you know, I love you, and I'm sorry that you're not only feeling that way, but that you're dealing with that, because that's real. And that, you know, white people don't get it, because we got our own issues, but we don't have anybody define us as a problem, you know, just without even knowing us.
That's true. So our job is not to go as white people, people of color, and say, let's forgive, let's move past it.
Yeah.
What is the job, especially as, of the white church, as we're moving forward? What do you think we can do?
We just need to love people radically and create situations where we have an opportunity to be with people who are different. I mean, years ago, when I was still in the parish in Richardson, we had this interchange or exchange between white and black churches. And in our case, we were matched up with the Gladewater Missionary Baptist Church down in the shadow of Veterans Hospital. And we kept that thing going for years. Mm-hmm. And it actually moved beyond program to a real authentic kind of friendship. And L.J. Pate would speak in my church, and I would speak in his, and we became good friends. And that was very intentional. I mean, it didn't serve any evangelistic purpose. It didn't serve any purpose to grow the church, but it was actually all about just being the people of the kingdom of God and being in each other's spaces and respecting that and loving that and, you know, creating an environment where that could happen.
Yeah, I hear a theme with you. Obviously, it's about relationships, getting to know people. I've Christina Cleveland, I think she's a social psychologist, she's a psychologist of some sort, and she's talked about in her book Disunity in Christ. I mean, relationship is the centerpiece of it, and it's as complicated as it is. It's still a simple solution of let's get to know people, get to know who you actually are,
right,
and start from there.
Right.
Now you you're part of. What Methodist church are you part of now?
My wife and I are at First Methodist downtown.
Now, isn't that the church where President Bush?
Bush is actually at Highland Park.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I had a picture of you and him sitting on the same pew.
Yeah, that would be okay.
Yeah, that would be okay.
I like him a lot better in Dallas.
Yeah. So when you think about like churches getting together, you have Republicans, you have Democrats. Yeah. I didn't mean to classify you as a Democrat. I don't know if you openly are a Democrat or not.
Sure I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Yellow Dog, by the way.
Yellow Dog. Okay, there we go. But did you grow up?
Yeah. I mean, my dad and my mom were sharecroppers who grew up 50 miles north of Abilene.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather on my mom's side was there as well. I grew up with that mindset. My dad, you know, escaped that, and then after the war came back to Dallas and got into real estate development and did well. But he was always still that always FDR Democrat.
Gotcha. So when you are a church, how can you have Republicans and Democrats still kind of work on this issue together when there's an assumption they're diametrically opposed on how to fix it?
Well, the good thing about the gospel is it transcends all that. And, we can hear, and I think that's an area where, you know, we have to hear each other and we have to respect each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I respect President Bush. I think he's a good man. I don't agree with lots that went on. I don't agree with everything that goes on now.
Yeah.
But so I think we have to kind of park that and work on the value-based opportunities we have to do right in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always right to help somebody who's hungry. It's always right to help someone who's needing a place to live. I think it's always right to be engaged with people who are fighting for fairness. One of the disconcerting things about now is how the extremes have seeped into churches, and that's all that seems to be there.
What do you mean?
Well, I can remember when Mark Hatfield and Everett Dirksen and Richard Nixon and George Romney and or just name them, Mark Hatfield, these Republicans who were conservative, very conservative capitalists, They now appear to be liberals, but they were just Main Street Republicans, and they work with people like John Kennedy and Ted Kennedy and Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson to get a lot of stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
And between World War II and the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the middle class emerged across America, and poverty declined by 19% during the years of Lyndon Johnson before the Gulf of Tonkin. And that was a time when the nation came together to support things like the GI Bill and, FHA and the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe and the economic development of the interstate highway system under Eisenhower. And there was all this stuff that just produced this gigantic middle class, both black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But now, primarily around two issues, abortion and homosexuality, extremists on the right have entered into the local scene, and it's almost like these big issues become so divisive we can't talk about other kinds of things. And then there's also this backlash against welfare expansion.
Mm-hmm.
I asked a group yesterday if they knew how many families in Dallas County were on welfare, on TANF. Well, it's like less than 6,000, because welfare is gone. And so if you're an extreme conservative on the right because of welfare, you're wasting a lot of energy because it's basically done.
Mm-hmm.
The Welfare Reform Act of 1996 ran its course, and there's a five-year limit and all that. Decreasingly numbers of people are actually on public assistance. So I don't know. It's a long-winded answer. It's probably not an answer at all. But I just think that we need to be willing, in the context of the church,
mm-hmm.
to sit down and listen to each other.
No.
And they have respectful disagreements.
Mm-hmm. And to be okay with that.
Be okay with that.
So what's your suggestion to the person, and I know this is probably someone you deal with a lot, who comes from the suburbs and says, I don't know what to do about right. being involved. Obviously, I know there's great stuff going on here. I want to do something. I don't even know where to start. I don't have a whole lot of time. I don't have a whole lot of money, but
right.
I care. What
yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are two or three things you can do. Everybody can do. You can pray.
Okay.
You can pray for us, right? You can do that.
Got that.
You can really put us on your prayer list. I had a young man call me the other day, and he said, Larry, I know I need to be more involved. I want to be a part of a group that you're suggesting of young professional people who could support us on a regular basis. I don't have any money. I said, do you have a dollar a month? He said, yeah, I got a dollar a month. I said, start there.
Hmm.
And money, people say all the time, well, I want to do more. I want to hands-on. I want to do more than money. I don't want to just throw money at a problem. Well, no one's throwing money at the problems down here. So don't underestimate the importance of surrendering some of your financial capital, because we can't do what we do without that. But then there are ways for you to pray and give and also come down here, show up, and just hang out.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not that hard.
Just hang out?
Just hang out.
Just
get to know some people. Just get to know some people.
Okay.
Help people get food in their car, or just hang out in the grocery store and talk to people. Or, we're looking right now for an army of coaches to work with the people we train for employment, to coach them up about how to be good employees. But we're working on the training protocol for those volunteers so that there's also the dimension that their partner can give them something.
Hmm.
Some understanding. So there's reciprocity.
Yeah,
always
that's
a goal.
Good.
It's not just me coming help.
What does that look like? What is the reciprocity?
We don't know yet. We're working at that.
Oh, that's
a
great idea.
We're going to have conversations with each other about life and about how family works and about,
mm-hmm.
Not only the frustration of the poor person, but also the frustration of the volunteer.
Hmm.
What if we could have a dialogue across these divides focused on employment and success,
mm-hmm.
that could then begin to talk? How do you feel about race? I've got a lay teaching committee that is helping me become a full member in the North Texas Conference, the United Methodist Church. That'll happen in June. And I've been meeting for 15 months with this group. And I've got homeless people in that group. I've got board members in that group. I've got staff people in that group. I'm kind of a weird outlier. We were studying a chapter from James Cone's book, The Spirituals and the Blues. And our whole conversation just opened up the black members of the group to tell us the truth about how they felt about their experience in America. And they were older, black folks there, and there were younger black folks there. It got so emotional. And we, you know, my white colleagues were wise enough and true enough that they didn't say anything. They just listened.
That's
and
good.
The longer that the talk went on, the more pain came out. And it was an incredibly sympathetic human exchange. And I think everybody left feeling like they were better understood. Everybody left feeling like they understood better. And that's what we're going after.
Yeah.
It's more than just a job. It's a job with success, you betcha. But it's also building relationships and knitting the community together in a way that it hasn't before.
Hmm. Okay, so we pray. We send a dollar. We come down to hang out. And then we read James Cone with people.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, we just open up our copy of The Lynching Tree and the Cross. And
there you go. Just read that.
Yeah. Well, Larry, let me tell you, I've been wanting to talk to you for a while since the start of the podcast. You've always been kind of a guest that I knew. I wanted to talk about this. Obviously, was a great opportunity to get you on the show. And I just want to say, I really am excited and proud as a Christian to say, we're on the same team, and I love what you're doing. And there's so many times you see people who wear the name Christian, and they do things, and you're just like, oh, you're embarrassing this whole thing of Jesus that I've given my life to, and now you're kind of selling it by what you're doing. But then you have examples of people like you, and I can go, yes, this is what I signed up for, and I really appreciate the example that you set. So
I appreciate your kindness and graciousness. You know, we're trying our best. We don't always succeed, but we're here every day.
Well, you're doing a great job, and thanks for your time. It's good talking with you, Larry.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.